Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice at the Theatre Museum. I'm Alex Sears and our guest this time is the playwright Ryan Craig, whose latest play, The Glass Room, is currently playing at the Hampstead Theatre in North London. Born in 1972, Ryan Craig first came to my attention with Happy Savages in 1998, and his recent successes have included Broken Road, which won a Fringe First at Edinburgh in 2005, and What We Did to Weinstein at the Meynier in the same year. Ryan has won the prestigious Peggy Ramsey Award and is a founder member of the Monsterists, a group of playwrights that have campaigned for more resources for bigger plays. He's also worked extensively in radio and television. Craig's trademark theatre style combines strong plot lines with controversial contemporary issues, and he has a penchant for leaving audiences hanging at the end of his plays, albeit in a highly satisfying way. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Ryan Craig.
Hello.
Can we start with The Glass Room? Could you say a few words about why you wrote the play?
That's quite difficult to answer, apart from, as with most of what I've written recently, it comes from a place of anger and wanting to set some things right about things. And I suppose the instinct for this was always there. I mean, I've always, growing up as in North London as a Jewish boy, you've always had the notion that there's a sort of strange, sinister notion of anti-Semitism is about, even though in our very English tolerant world that we live, it's not. It doesn't come at you in an aggressive way, and it doesn't come at you in insults or violence. I didn't have that, but it comes in a slightly more sinister, more subtle way. And the character of Eleanor is a sort of, I suppose, an apotheosis of all these things. This sort of, and certainly for the first half of the play, this very intellectual, reasonable sounding, charming historian who thinks it's perfectly acceptable to deny the suffering of so many millions of Jews. And so this year the play has come to the fore because of the imprisonment, I suppose, of David Irving in Austria. And I was watching Question Time, and one of the questioners in the audience, again, a very reasonable, liberal, I suppose, woman who just wants the best for the world, said, "Do you think we should have put him in prison? You know, shouldn't we allow him to say what he wants?" And the panel was pretty much, in fact, I think apart from a Tory MP, was pretty much, there was a consensus that he should just be ignored, that he was just a loony right-wing Nazi sympathiser who we should just ignore. And my gut instinct was that things are not quite that simple, that you can't just ignore him. He's a dangerous man. He's a man who is intelligent, who has influence. And if we ignore him, then we're going to be in trouble because he's just going to continue feeling free to write what he wants. By, of course, the same token, if you gag him, we're going to be thinking, oh, he's interesting, we're gagging him, we're putting him in prison, he's a political prisoner. And so those two sides of the coin started coming up. And I always look for the two big sides of a coin when I start writing.
That's right. You've always talked about starting off with a paradox. And it might be useful at this moment to give a brief outline of the plot of the play.
The Glass Room. Well, Miles is a human rights lawyer who, on the surface, seems incredibly idealistic. But I think he is finding his humanity through his work because he doesn't want to confront humanity. That's a bit messy for him. He's a bit of a control freak. And he takes on this case of Eleanor Mannion, who's a Holocaust denier.
Well, she's not exactly, though, is she? She doesn't actually. She, at one point, you actually say in the play that she says, in fact, I'm not denying that the Holocaust happened. I'm simply saying, questioning the evidence for gas chambers in the death camps.
Yes.
In other words, all those millions of Jews, they died accidentally, and they weren't the victims of organised genocide. I think that's her argument.
Yeah, it's even more specific than that. She never really gets into detail about why they die or who kills them or if they die accidentally. What she's concerned about, her priority is to say, we have no significant evidence to suggest that these gas chambers existed for as a killing machine. And the play sets out to demolish that argument. Because the argument is, if you look at it, towards the end of the play, towards the end of the first half, I know a lot of the audience who are not conversive with the history itself are thinking, well, hang on, maybe there is a point to be made. And that's why we can't just ignore the Irvings of the world. That's why you have to confront the Irvings. And my point with the play is quite simple, which is that confront them, but don't gag them. I mean, in confronting somebody, you necessarily can't gag them because you have to allow them to come back at you. You can't just sit them there, tie them up and say, this is the truth, and that's the end of it. So that's essentially how the play begins.
With Eleanor,
yes.
The attractive thing from the point of view of the theatre-goer is that you give her plenty of rope, not only to tangle herself up, but also you put in her words some things that surely we all believe. And surely we believe, as Eleanor says, that history is not just a rock that is unchanging, that if you allow consensus to stifle your own personal opinions, humankind can't advance. So you deliberately give her the best possible arguments she could have.
Sure, because if I didn't make her credible at that point, you know, at the beginning, then she's just a loony and she's just insane, essentially, yeah. And there's nothing dangerous about her or inviting or seductive. And she has to be, otherwise Miles's point of her, you know, towards the end of the play, we find out that Miles really doesn't want her to be, he's a bit hypocritical because he doesn't want her to speak to the world. He wants to keep her in her place. He doesn't want her to grandstand. And he knows that the reason he doesn't want her to grandstand is because he knows she's quite interesting and inspiring in some ways and therefore terrifying. So, yes, she had to be dangerous. And so in order to make her dangerous, she had to be at some point credible. But by the same token, her credibility has to be knocked, and it is in the second half. I don't know if you wanted to get onto that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that she's very credible, and then obviously she has to collapse at some point dramatically, and it's to do with the revelation that she's anti-Semitic and very profoundly anti-Semitic. And of course, I wasn't surprised by that, and in a sense, the audience isn't, because after all, you can reinterpret various aspects of Nazi history. We could argue between us as to exactly when Adolf Hitler decided in practice to eliminate, destroy, kill all of the Jewish population of Europe. And that would be an honest debate.
As she mentions in the play, she talks about the intentionalists and the functionalists who disagree with how the final solution was arrived at. What they agree on is that there was such a thing as a final solution.
And the element of bad faith in her character and in, I think, David Irving, is that it's really very difficult to sanely imagine that the entire Holocaust genocide could have been invented by the survivors and that they were telling a fairy story, in other words, why to set up the State of Israel.
Yeah, and I, the way I described it to Sian, who plays Eleanor, which I think was a key, when I sort of discovered it in a discussion like this, after the play had been written, and I remember running to her because I knew it would be helpful, which is that she, to all intents and purposes, is a bright, well-informed patrician person who has a fatal flaw, and her fatal flaw is her anti-Semitism, her hatred of the other. And in this case, it's the other is represented by the Jews, although it turns out she just doesn't like anyone who's not.
Yeah, it could be Muslims or blacks.
Yeah, it doesn't matter really. You know, she's just got that. That's her fatal flaw. That's what's eating away at her. And in the sense that that is what the play is about. It's about what hatred does to the body that hates, and how the hated party responds to that, and how they deal with it, how they confront it, and how it changes them and shifts them. Miles being the hated party, even though it's a sort of strange connection he has with Eleanor, because she. I don't know if this is giving away anything for the people who see it, but she knows all the way along the line that he's Jewish, and is, in fact, the reason she appoints him as her lawyer. And he's sort of denying it from her, thinking, well, we don't need to get into that sort of personal stuff.
As you mentioned before, Sian Thomas plays Eleanor. I think you told me that it's interesting about the audience reaction at the Hampstead Theatre when she spouts her ideas.
Well, I should start by saying that this play was very much written with the audience at Hampstead in mind, and a community that I come from. And it was very much a dialogue between myself and that community, which is to say, this is probably the most difficult person we have to deal with in our safe environment. Somebody who denies suffering, who has a very clever way of coming at us with their hatred and their bigotry. And so it was very much, I very much wanted to write something that communicated to them, that engaged with them. And if other people were interested in that, then that's great. And if it is a good play, I don't know that. I've just written it. I have no idea if it's a good play. And it reaches other people, then that's great. But this was very much written for that audience, to engage with them at this time. And but the audience doesn't know that coming in. They know it's about this Holocaust-denying historian. That's all they really know. So this first Saturday night was absolutely packed to the rafters, and I would say, 80% Jewish, maybe more, and some religious people as well, which I was surprised by for some reason, I don't know why, because Sabbath had gone out, you know, it was fine. And as soon as Sian came on stage, she comes on scene two. The first scene's kind of a nice sort of domestic comic scene. Scene two, Sian Thomas comes on stage smoking, and there is a wave of hostility towards her, an incredible, visceral, palpable feeling that you get in the audience, and speaking to her afterwards, she could feel, I mean, feel it, physically feel the hatred directed towards her. I mean, it was an unconscious thing, of course. But,
and she's such an attractive actress anyway, which is, that makes it also.
And such a nice, charming person in real life, of course, you know, and doesn't, you know, and no actress, you know, goes on stage in order to get, even if they're playing Medea, as Sian compares this part to playing. You know, you always try and find, and this is the interesting thing, and this is why the part is written as it is. In order for Sian to get into this monster, there has to be an angle. She has to, in some way, love her, in some way, find the connection with herself. And that's why even the last speech that Eleanor has, there is a lot of credibility when she talks about the re-election of Bush and Blair being its own political mendacity that we are guilty of ourselves. And she calls us all deniers. There is there's an element where a lot of people could get with that program, you know what I mean? But the audience were sort of, they couldn't help themselves. I mean, this was the character that they had come to see physicalised, and they couldn't help themselves but emit waves of hate. And talking to her afterwards, she said it was an extraordinary experience. And I think, you know, it was an extremely brave performance that night.
Yes, I agree. And to move on, though, Miles, the human rights lawyer, clearly he's denying his own past. Could you say a bit about that?
Well, it's a bit more complicated for him because he's sort of in this limbo where his father is Jewish and his mother is Catholic. So, by Talmudic law, he is not Jewish, but his father is very proud of his heritage, and he tries to instill it in Miles, and he wants Miles to see that it's important. And you can imagine from the way it's written that that's something that's been going on since his childhood. So it's a consciousness that he has, rather than him growing up and not thinking about it. It's something he's constantly conscious about. And his father tries to get him these books, the Big Book of Jewish Why, which is sort of a version of what I got when I was bar mitzvahed, and the Bigger Book of Jewish Why, which is the joke. But there is, I think such a book exists. I don't know if you got one, but I got both. I think it's like the more books of Jewish Why or something like that. It doesn't matter. I've lost my thread now. Miles. So he's in a bit of a quandary because he is one thing and to some people and he isn't to others. And I think that's... what he represents is the way that... where we are in this country where you have cultures and integration, and you want to retain culture, and if you're from a Muslim community, an Indian community, a Sikh community, a Jewish community, there's lots about your culture which you find absolutely essential to your identity. I mean, you can't just dispense with it. Even if you try, it sort of comes back at you. And by the same token, there's integration into a Western, democratic, modern, secular society. Now, I've always thought that the Jews have a bit of a head start on this because we've been at it for thousands of years. And so I do think that we have more to say on this subject than we're letting on, possibly. So Miles is that character. He is part of the secular world. He very much is. He's a human rights lawyer. He's a public school boy. He has absolutely integrated. There's no question of that, as has his father. But he still has this thing, this fundamental thing, this sense of self, this sense of a connection to a community and a past and a history, which he cannot avoid, even if he, at the beginning of the play, denies it. And his shift at the end of the play is that he suddenly turns around and he says, OK, there's something inside me that I'm going to have to deal with, you know. And that is brought about by confronting this monster of Eleanor, who has just pure hatred, you know.
That's really clear, but there's also a symbolic side, isn't there? Because I remember reading the programme note where you say that Miles is also a kind of wandering Jew. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think it's all connected because he's never at home anywhere. You know what I mean? I mean, even if, for example, he went to Israel, I mean, that would be getting on to the previous play, he would not feel at home. He would still feel, well, hang on, I'm English, actually. You know, I'm not Israeli, I'm English. And yet in London, he feels, well, I am English, but also there's someone like Eleanor who won't let it lie, won't let us integrate properly.
But he's also restless emotionally, isn't he? Because you give him a backstory where he has a marriage that he's moved on from. He's unable to connect with this young woman, Tara, who is his new landlady.
Yes.
There's a kind of emotional inability there.
Well, yes, I mean, it's very much something that it was very specific in the production. You have the two sides of the stage. You have the animar and the animus. You have the sort of masculine side where the muscular debates are going on between Eleanor and Miles. And then you have this much more feminine world, which is dominated by Tara. And he is much more comfortable with Eleanor at the beginning of the play. That's the point. He has much more connection with this woman who you know, we see as this monster, this terrible creature. And yet there's a real ease with them together at the beginning of the play, and they really agree on so many things. Whereas with Tara, he has a very awkward beginning. And what happens is he gets much more in touch with his emotional depths because he starts to feel things for Tara that he's never felt for anyone else, and so he crosses, you know, he becomes more comfortable in the feminine world and much more uncomfortable in the masculine world.
A couple of the reviews accused you, Ryan, of sacrificing character to the play's issues. Now, were you conscious of that, or do you deny it? Or
Certainly not conscious of it. I think that it's difficult to respond to critics because, you know, if they're nice to you and you say, and you complain about it, then you're being churlish. And if they're not nice to you, then of course you're going to complain about it. It's a play, you know. I mean, I'm discussing issues, but I really don't think that I think it's wrong to suggest that I manipulate the character, because character arrives fully formed. Character of Eleanor arrives as an anti-Semite. There's nothing I can do about that. That's what she is. That's why she's denying that there were gas chambers. That's the whole reason she does it. She's not doing it from any historical perspective, because we know that, because we present all the arguments and she still doesn't accept it. So, of course she's an anti-Semite, and there's a point, as you said, the audience is not surprised, and nor should they be, that she explodes in her, somebody called it a Mel Gibson moment, which I thought was absolutely right, because it made it very credible that today, in this world, a person who is functioning in society, who has a job, who's on telly, can suddenly explode with just pure hatred, which is, you know, repressed, and just a person who's full of bile, if finally, you know, is pushed to the point where they just let loose. Of course the audience is expecting that. It's electric when it happens because of the performance, and it's a moment of sort of, it's almost operatic when it happens. And, you know, so the accusation, what should I have done? Should I have made her arguments more credible? Well, how can I? It did happen. Her arguments have no basis in reality. Her arguments come from her hatred. So we have to have that moment. The audience needs that moment.
Talking of reality and everything, as you also acknowledge in the programme note, it isn't actually illegal to deny the existence of gas chambers at the moment in Britain. That's not a problem for me. I recognise the play is a creative fiction. Do you think it undermines the arguments in any way?
Well, I don't think so, no, because, number one, Tony Blair has already discussed the possibility of bringing in a law denying the Holocaust, so it's on the table. That's number one. Number two, the law that he uses, the Attorney General in the play, this fictional Attorney General in the play, uses, is the race and religious hatred law. So you can't incite a religious hatred. And all the lawyers I spoke to on this subject said you could make a case for the denial of the gas chambers to be an incitement to hate this group of people because they came up with it. So, you know, I mean, it would be hard to take that case to court, but if her book was particularly unpleasant and insightful, but there's a better word, it will come to me, inflammatory. If it was very inflammatory, you could make a case under existing laws. The other thing is that in this, that you only have to look to Austria it's either these laws exist. You have to look to France, where there's a bill, I think it's a white paper, we'd call it, to ban denial of the Armenian genocide in Turkey. So I think it's very prescient, personally. I mean, that's why the play was on.
Do you think, you know, as a human being as well as a playwright, Ryan, that it's good that there are so many laws bringing in so many different ways of limiting freedom?
That feels like a leading question.
It is.
So, no, I mean, I don't think so. I'm not, but the point is, I'm a playwright, and I'm not into jurisprudence. I'm not a lawyer or a politician. My job is to use the debate to see if I can do something interesting with the people who are debating and how their debates and their points of view affect their personal relationships. That's all I'm really trying to
do. We didn't actually mention, but you also introduce Miles's father,
yes.
Who has a very good speech about how the tabloid newspapers fan and stoke up racial hatred by reporting about Holocaust deniers. So obviously the idea that we should just be free to say anything and make fools of ourselves isn't something that you have much sympathy with either.
It's not up to me to legislate, that's the point. I just present what I think are the arguments, and then I try and write a play around it, and it's extraordinary to me that I do believe that some people came to the play expecting me to solve the paradox of free speech and to come up with a fabulous new argument for free speech or against free speech and to tell people where to draw the line. Well, that's not my job, for starters, and I'm very flattered that people think I'm that intelligent, and I'm really not. I'm just a playwright, and I can do jokes, and I can do characters, and I can do structure, and that's all I can do, really.
Well, any play that has jokes about Coldplay and Snow Patrol can't be such a bad thing. Maybe we could loop back now and have a look at what we did to Weinstein.
Sure.
It's another, if you like, Jewish issue play. And could you tell us a bit about it? It's got a character called Josh who's grown up in London and wants to go to Israel and help defend it against suicide bombers and so on. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, the play is essentially set in one location, which is in Josh's cell. He's being held for a crime we don't know exactly what it is. We sort of start to find out that it's got something to do with a terrorist suspect and something to do with a dogfight he was involved in the West Bank. And through his incarceration and his interrogation, he starts to think about recent events in his life. So he goes back to when he gets together with an old girlfriend, how he confronts his father, who he's estranged from, who's dying, and it goes back and forwards. It's not linear, and essentially it's about his need to belong, which he finds extremely difficult. He's a character who is again full of rage and confusion and trying to find what is his fundamental identity. Is he Jewish, or is he English, or is he Israeli, as he becomes, of course. That's a difficult thing. Is he a soldier? Is he a writer, which he's trying to be? And essentially that's what it's about. And all the characters in the play are in some way trying to come to terms with what they are and what their purpose is, and what their purpose is in terms of how they fit politically. I mean, again, the play is written to say, because I started looking around me and thinking, well, we're becoming more and more polarised by the external world, you know, where people within families and friends, and I mean, I was having enormous arguments with people I've known all my life, and family and brothers, you know, although I have one brother, where I took a particular position on, for example, the Israel-Palestinian question, and they took another, and it became such a deeply difficult thing to deal with that it actually affected the personal relationship. It crept in, whereas before we were having, you'd have an argument about Margaret Thatcher or the unions, whatever. And I'm sure that if you were in Sheffield or wherever, I'm throwing this out now, and you were arguing about Thatcher, that was much more personal. But to us, it felt like these were the issues that were actually going to affect our personal relationships. And so that's what the play is. The play sets people against each other who are either in love or father and daughter, or father and son, or brother and sister.
And looking at both of these plays, and I know that you've discussed this with Arnold Wesker, is there such a thing as a Jewish play?
I think it's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure if I know the answer to it. I mean, I guess there are certain... You could possibly say there's a certain self-effacing humour that creeps in. There's a certain moral rage that creeps in that I think that we both sort of do to some extent, although I think he's the master at moral rage. I don't think I'd get close to that. I think there is an optimism born out of the constant pessimism about our current situation, and I think the only thing you can do if you write is to finally have an optimism. And I think both The Glassroom and What We Did to Weinstein, I would say, have an optimistic end, even though it's a draining experience. I think both of them are a draining experience because there's grim things that happen or are discussed. But I don't know. I mean, it's a broad question. I think that starting to write is something that is so... It's such an insane thing to do, and it's such a difficult sometimes thing to do. It's almost a con trick you have with yourself. It's a confidence trick, because you have to believe, number one, that you'll get to the end of what you're writing, and number two, that anyone would be remotely interested in it. And I think that having a Jewish mother helps that, because she's interested in everything that you do. I mean, everything. So you sort of have this innate confidence to start the game off. I mean, I don't know how other people do it. If you're Richard Binion from Hull, maybe you have a different way of looking at it. But I think that there are... That possibly explains why Jews write rather than run, whatever it is.
At that point, maybe we could talk a bit about the Monstrists.
Sure.
You were one of the four founding members, is that right? Could you say a bit about how it all started?
With Richard Bean, Colin Teevan and Sarah Woods in a room after seeing a play which has sort of gone from my memory now. I can't even remember what it was, but I remember it was big and there were lots of people in it, and it was I think it was a German play. It doesn't matter. The point is that we all sat there and thought, wait a minute, why are they spending resources and effort and money and people and bodies, you know, on a play that has very little to do with where we are now, is not written by a living writer, and isn't really that interesting. And we realised very quickly we were connected in this one way, even though we were very different writers. We were connected in agreeing that where were the resources for the new writers to write big themes on big stages with lots of people. Now, I'm not saying that we all have to do that all the time, and I'm certainly not saying that you can't now write plays with three people. Of course you can, there are four people in The Glassroom, but it is a big play in terms of theme. And I think that it was a bit of a, for me personally, it was a watershed moment after flailing around. I'd written Happy Savages, which essentially is about four young people getting together and finding themselves. And I suddenly realised that the world's changed. I'm not interested in that anymore. They're an important thing. The world's on fire, essentially, politically. And it has to be addressed directly, I felt, although other people, for example, Carol Churchill, will come at it in a different way. That's because she's a different writer. But I felt the world had to be addressed directly, politically and personally. And it changed me completely as a writer, Monsterism. And that's why I sort of mentioned it in those terms.
And how would you define a big play?
Well, I think that I may veer from my monstrist colleagues on this, but I think a big play has to start with being about something big in terms of political statement, broad statements, in terms of your character, even if your characters are, for example, homeless or disenfranchised, they have to in some way be the king of their space, or the queen of their space. And I think certainly Eleanor fits that. She's a big character in terms of what she says, what she represents, and how she deals with the people around her, her status. So I believe that big plays have to start that way. Otherwise, they can't justify... If you want to have 25 people on stage, I don't think you can justify it if it's just about people in a club or people in...
Me and my mates.
Exactly. Although, yeah, I'm sure that someone will come along and write that play. I mean, Market Boy is a case in point, I think, although that is certainly about, you know, Thatcherism and the economy and the, you know, all our markets, you know, the market, the world market. So in some ways that's a big theme, although it looks on the surface possibly like a play about small characters just trying to, you know, a kid trying to get laid, essentially, is what it looks like it's about. I think it's... Bernard Shaw, is it Bernard Shaw? No, William Goldman, sorry, same thing, says, what is the thing about, and then what is it really about? And I think that both The Glassroom and Market Boy do those things, because The Glassroom looks like it's about the free speech argument, and actually it's about identity and hatred and bigotry. And I think you can sometimes miss on a first seeing, or if you're not, or if you come to the theatre thinking you're going to see a certain thing, you can miss what the thing is really about, and I think that's a shame. But my thing is with monsterism is that the theme is the important thing. What is the theme?
It's been about 5 years since monsterism sort of started. How successful do you think it's been? I can only think of two writers. That would be Moira Buffini and David Eldridge, who've had command of really big stages. The rest seem to be still at that level of 200 to 300 seats.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're just warming up, to be honest. I think Harvest was a big play, you know, in Royal Court Downstairs. Certainly a big play in terms of theme, scope and range and, you know, in the Royal Court main house. I think that Roy's play, Sing Your Heart Out, is a monstrous play and has lots of people in it and is about race and belonging and tribal.
Well, I suppose what I'm saying is that why aren't you all in the West End in those 500 to 700 seat theatres writing plays that have a commercial aspect as well as the subsidised side? I mean, in your case, for example, you produce very good plots, so you can't be accused of turning your nose up at that kind of tradition which delivers a dramatic climax.
Well, I think I have an answer to this in some ways. One is that we don't, or we haven't, come from a tradition where you write for the lead actor or actress. Even a part like Eleanor, which is a mammoth part, you have to be a very brave actor to take that role on. And it still isn't, the play isn't about her, the play is about Miles, who's a 30-year-old human rights lawyer. And I think that because we come from a tradition where we wrote ensemble plays, We thought about the play as the metaphor and the play as a piece of poetry and a play for where all the actors were served. You know, you didn't shortchange any of your characters. We didn't come from a tradition where you wrote for the big, great leading actor or actress. You wrote these big, sort of like Schiller does or... you know, all those Jacobean dramatist.
John Osborne
does it. I guess Hare does it in his way. We sort of come from, because we were so dominated by Pinter, I guess that we come from a slightly different tradition. And I think that, and when we start to learn, and we talk about this a lot, when we start to learn how to write those mammoth parts, you know, those great big journeys, and we get someone big to do them, I think you'll see us on the West End. Some of us, I don't know who. But like I said, we're just warming up. We're just learning this stuff. It's hard writing plays, and it's certainly hard to change or to become, you know, to the playwright that you need to become.
On that characteristically optimistic note, I think we could leave it. Thank you very much, Ryan Craig, on behalf of Theatre Voice at the Theatre Museum. Thank you.
Pleasure.